This is Dylan.
This is Nick. And you're listening to
Colloquium, Colloquium.
All right. Here we are.
Roll Tide.
Podcasting again. It's been like a month.
Has it been a month? Yeah, I guess it has.
I think it has, because we released the D-Stat episode.
Yep, and then we missed the next 2 weeks slot, and now we're back.
That's right. I've had some good conversations about the D-Stat
episode. Really?
A lot of people have followed up on that one. So
great, yeah. I had one minus one. So I've had zero conversations about the boxing podcast.
Yeah. But you haven't been around in terms of, like, our community. You haven't been around a lot the last few weeks.
Around a ton, yeah.
You traveled, and I guess we had the beach trip, though.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, right?
You didn't have any conversation? I feel like it came up a couple times there. But
did it?
Maybe we weren't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Missed out.
I guess so.
Missed out.
I guess so. Boxing is not a sin?
No, I don't think it is when done appropriately, as they say, or when unspectacularized, I think is what we were talking about.
Yes, yeah. That's the nuance. That's the caveat to it.
Yeah.
All right. What's new with Colloquium?
What is new with Colloquium? Let's see. Dylan is showing his mug to the camera, which, by the way, that's a new thing that
there's
we have.
There's a camera. That's new. Yeah, okay. Oh, we just doubled it. Thing there.
The mug is new. The camera's new.
The Colloquium mug you can get on our Instagram. What do you call it? The link tree. Click on the link tree.
Yes.
You can get merch via there. Got a few different options. Well, I think we only have one option for the mug, but I changed the option to make it slightly cheaper, or at least I'll double check, make sure I've changed that. Hmm. I'm thinking about also ordering a bunch of these mugs. And when we go to the University of Alabama, which is also new.
Oh, yeah.
We're doing in October. I'm thinking about, like, having these to sell.
Yeah. That sounds like a really good idea.
I think it'd be cool.
I hope they sell, or else we'll have a lot of
A lot of Colloquium mugs, which I would be okay with.
Yeah, that'd be
cool.
Can you
imagine, like, my whole cupboard is just filled with Colloquium mugs, and it's like people come over, it's like, hey, have some coffee.
That's
here's
right.
A Colloquium mug.
Do you need 10 cups of coffee?
Well, I assume I'd have 10 people over.
Oh,
not
yeah,
just
fair.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Or one person drink 10 cups of coffee. So that could happen too.
Right.
So that's new. You've been socially active.
I have been posting on social media quite a bit more. Been slack the past couple weeks, but I'm hoping to get back into it. That's something we're trying to do, is post some videos and other various things on Instagram. So hope you enjoy.
What about Nicholas? What's new with Nicholas?
Let's see, what is new with me? I'm a soccer coach, and we have started our fall soccer season. It is, the train is rolling downhill, so that's great. A huge blessing to be around the players. I started reading Mere Christianity, as a random thing. And I'm really, really enjoying that. I've never read it. Yeah. And C.S. Lewis is just great. He just has... I was telling one of my friends this the other day, that he just has a very distinct voice when he reads, or when he writes. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're holding up the Signature Classics
it's in here
edition.
Somewhere.
That's exactly what I'm reading out of, actually. Yeah. Zach has a version, my brother. He just has a very distinctive voice when he writes. It's very matter-of-fact, very English.
It. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So
I love that guy.
I love it. Really enjoying my Christianity.
C.S. Lewis, which stands for?
Clive Staples.
Clive Staples, also known as Jack for some reason. I don't know where you get Jack as a nickname out of Clive, but that's what they called him.
Yeah, you know, there's an A in there and a C in there and an S in... No, sorry.
Okay.
That's as far as I go.
All right, okay. But okay. Yeah, that's awesome. Mere Christianity. I think I said this to you off the air a few weeks ago when you mentioned you had started it. I think it's like one of the most underrated apologetics books, because it's like, I don't know, C.S. Lewis is so popular that I don't think he gets a reputation for being like a philosopher or apologist, but a lot of people don't realize how philosophically intelligent he was and how good his apologetics were. And yeah, he's just brilliant.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah. I did really enjoy that book.
I'm glad you're doing soccer too. I have to say soccer season's a little bittersweet for me, because I mean, you get to be doing soccer, and I know you love that, and it makes you come to life, but I feel like I see a lot less of you during the soccer season. So hence we've Yeah. It's been a month since we podcasted.
It is harder for me to be around, but is what it is. We'll do what we can.
It is what it is.
The phrase that means,
nothing. I was hoping we could say it. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. What's new with you?
What's new with me? Started back at school. I want to tell a story. This is a story. I told this last night. This is not really what's new with me. It's just what I was reflecting on today. So I have this memory. I don't think I've ever told you this before, but I have this mutual memory with my brother PJ. About this time when we were at the beach, when we were children, I was probably 8, he was like 11, something like that, as my chair sinks down and I raise it back up. We have the same memory that we have had conversations about multiple times, and we both remember it. And what this memory is we're at the beach and we're waiting on an elevator at our hotel or condo or whatever. And we're like jumping at the elevator as it opens and like scaring people. And this one time we're doing this and we jump out and we weren't expecting anybody to be in the elevator. It's kind of why we were jumping at it. We weren't actually doing it to scare people. And then there's this lady in there and she like jumps and then she says, "Now you've scared a Scottish person," because she was Scottish. And my brother and I just thought it was the strangest thing, right? And so whenever we talk about it, you know, years later, it's like, yeah, it was so weird when that happened. Remember that? Like, yeah. It was so funny. And then a couple, maybe like a year or two ago, this is PJ, my brother PJ, I brought up this memory again. And he says, "Do you know if that really happened? Or was that just a dream that you told me about? And then we've talked about, and like, we both remember you having the dream." And I truly now to this day, I don't know whether it actually happened or not. But I think I'm leaning towards it was actually a dream, because who would say, "Now you've scared a Scottish person"? That's just weird.
Yeah.
But I recall it, and my brother recall it, as if it actually happened, because we had like revisited it so many times together.
That's really weird.
Isn't that weird?
Is the memory in a place that you frequented, that you've been before?
It's not a super vivid. Vague. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, weird. I remember what it looks like. I remember this little hallway with two elevators, and I think it was the right elevator.
Wow. This is weird. Yeah. That's a really weird thing.
But I've never been back to that place.
Okay.
That I know of.
Huh. We'll have to seek out this place then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what's new with me. I was telling that at Sam and Greg's last night to some of our friends, and they were like, "Yeah, that probably didn't happen." I was like, maybe, you know, I don't know.
Who knows? Guess we'll never
maybe
know.
Maybe I'll find out in heaven.
Yeah, in heaven.
That would be interesting. What if I meet the Scottish person in heaven? This is the other giveaway, and then we can move on. This is the other kind of giveaway that makes me think it might be a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Is when PJ and I were talking about it last, he asked what the lady looked like, and as I just started describing her, I realized she looked like the lady, the Scottish lady who hosted the show The Weakest Link.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes sense that I would have dreamed that. And used the face of the one Scottish lady I never knew of.
Interesting. Could be a clue there.
Yeah, who knows? But if I meet this lady in heaven. All right, lady, if you're in heaven listening to this or on earth listening to this.
Oh my gosh.
If I meet you again, I need you just to say when you see me, "Now you've scared a Scottish person," in your normal Scottish accent, okay? Can you do that?
And then you'll both know.
Then we'll both know. Oh, all right, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing this? Why are we talking about this?
Next.
All right, we should podcast. We should talk about our topic, eh?
Let's do it.
What are you talking about, Nick?
What's the deal with kids these days?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about evangelizing the youths.
Yeah.
As they say.
Yeah, Gen Z. Generation Z. You know, it's funny, My friends and I in the neighborhood, we used to make these videos of us doing stupid things, and we called it "Crazy Stunts Kids Do These Days." It was so much fun.
Nice.
Like, it was so weird. We'd like run into a bush or like jump off a swing. It was so stupid. But kids these days. What's funny is that we're able to talk about youth. We're still youth, right?
I mean, speak for yourself. I'm 29. Yeah.
You know, but anyway. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like we're in this place where it's like, we're starting to be able to talk about the youth as an abstract.
Like they're not us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, that's a good point.
People younger than us who are beginning to set the tone for the predominant culture.
Yes.
Right? And I think we're really at a kind of monumental point for this in general, in that a new generation is starting to come of age. So the millennial generation, which you and I both belong to, but we're both on the tail end. I'm actually really on the tail end. Most statistics I see starts Gen Z at 1997. I was born in 1995. So we're the tail end of millennials, which is also an interesting perspective because I think we can share more in common with Gen Z than your typical millennial.
True.
But I definitely, when I look at traits, generational trends, I definitely seem to identify more with the millennial generation. Would you say the same, or have you thought much about it?
I haven't thought a ton about it, but I know what I've heard in the past. Characteristics of millennials I do really identify with. So yeah. I actually don't know much about Gen Z characteristics, so maybe this will be a learning experience
for me. I've got some for you. We both do work with Gen Z, right? So working with high schoolers, the high school population, that's what they are. The college population now, all Gen Z as well, for the most part. I mean, the traditional college generation. So I think a lot of our work, even my work in Focus, was with kind of that early Gen Z kind of demographic. So most of my work in youth ministry of any kind has been with this generation. So some basic trends. Talk about 1997 to 2012 are the birth years we're looking at. So actually people being born now. So like my nieces are in the new generation, which I heard is going to be Gen Alpha. So
okay.
Starting over. Gen Z, interestingly, was it a third of the global population? 2.5 billion people belong to Gen Z. Pretty significant. They're what you call digital natives, which means that they grew up in the digital world. Gen Z, and this is a really significant marker of Gen Z, is they've grown up and lived their whole life with smartphones being ubiquitous. So they've never had to learn, adapt from dumb phones to smartphones, or adapt to a social media age from a non-social media age. That's just what they know.
Yeah.
So that's really significant, I think, to their upbringing. They are 25% Hispanic. This is in America in particular, I believe. 52% white. So we're becoming more and more diverse as a American people. And the last note I put is that they're similar politically to millennials. A lot of this comes from Pew research study that I was reading.
Gotcha. Yeah, when did the iPhone come out again? I think it was 2007.
That's correct, yep.
Yeah, so just as another specific note, I really correlate the beginning of...
The end.
Yeah, the beginning of the end as
with the iPhone.
I don't know when, quote-unquote, the digital age began, but I really correlate the digital age in the sense that we know it now with the birth of the iPhone. So yeah. Just to give everyone an idea, 1997 is the first year of Gen Z. They would have been 10 years old when the iPhone came out. So still right. very yeah. informative years, 10 years yeah. old.
Well, and then the age that we're working with now, they're born... Oh, gosh, math. Born in the 2000s, right?
Yeah, so my older, I'm a high school girls coach, and they were born in 2005, 2006, yes. are the oldest.
So girls. By the time yeah. they're 10 years old, the iPhone doesn't just exist, but it's ubiquitous.
Mainstream.
It's in every household, right?
Yeah. People have the iPhone 6 running. Yeah.
yeah. Running People around, so. Who are in sixth grade are getting their first phone, and it's an iPhone, right? That's huge.
Yeah.
That's vastly different than the way that even we grew up.
That's right. Right.
I didn't have an iPhone until I was a sophomore in college. And I'm only a little bit older than these people. So.
Yeah, I actually had one when I was in eighth grade, and it was like a huge
you had a smartphone.
Yeah, an iPhone, and it was a huge deal. It was the first. It was it had just come out, first version of the iPhone. My parents said, "What the heck? We'll go ahead and get our child an iPhone. They'll love it."
Did they regret it?
I mean, no, I don't think so. Both my brother Zach and I got it. So Zach got it when he was in sixth grade in 2007. Winter 2007. So.
Dude, I remember I was the youngest, so I always the rules got looser. So my oldest brother, I think, got a phone, again, not smartphone, flip phone, when he started driving, so when he was 16. PJ, I think, got one early because when he was at some point in high school, before he was driving age, he, keep in mind, he was really young in high school, but He was just, I think with his baseball schedule, he was often in a situation where they didn't know what time to pick him up and they got him a cell phone. My parents did. And then I, being the spoiled youngest child, got a phone in eighth grade.
All right.
Actually, at my eighth grade graduation, I believe it was.
Is it a flip phone? One of those razors?
I think that it was a Razor.
No
way. I think
a
Razor was my first phone. Yeah,
those things were awesome. Pretty nifty,
right? And I remember it was my first or second phone was a Razor. But I just remember, like, you feel so cool.
Yeah.
When you have one of those. And, like, I had nobody to text, really. But, like, I mean, this is kind of a embarrassing thing for pre-adolescent me or adolescent me. But sometimes I would, like, pretend to text.
Nice.
Like, under the table just to look like I was cool.
Yeah, that'll show.
Did you ever do that?
No, I don't think so. Not from what I remember. So, yeah, that was just you.
Yep, just me. All right, I'm fine with that. I don't mind sharing that. I'm a new person now.
There's something really special about the old flip of the flip phone. Mm-hmm. You know, just hope someone's texting me, someone's calling me. Shink. You know? Hello?
Talk to me.
Anyway, that was a big tangent, but worth it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you got to set the stage. That's our upbringing, right? Okay, I guess we can move on from that. Just what trends then have we noticed? So we both work with the youth, right? Yeah. So I teach high school. I coach high school age. I've worked with, you know, we both did college ministry with this kind of early Generation Z. What else do I feel like I do something else with young people? But and you coach soccer, right?
Religious education too. I guess that's exactly. Teaching. Yeah.
Yeah. So we both do a lot of work, enough to have a decent gauge. We're not going to be experts in youth ministry or experts in sociology to understand these, but enough that we've made some observations over the time. And so what are some of those trends that you've noticed about the youth of today, the kids these days?
Yeah, the ones that I've noted here, I don't know specifically relate to Gen Z. And in fact, I'm pretty sure they don't just relate to Gen Z. They relate to all youth. Maybe you'll have some more insights into specifically Gen Z. But one of the things that I've noted here is their ability to change habit quickly. And this is something that I've really admired in witnessing the high school players, especially that I've coached, and even some of the younger ones that I've coached, that when they set their mind to something as a rule, they have the ability to do hard things well and quickly. I specifically noted this in, like, in the soccer environment, which, you know, is not necessarily translated to normal life, but I actually think it is. I think that is a trait of young people to change their habits for the good and maybe even for the worse, but I've specifically noted for the good quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. They're in such a formative phase of their life. Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways I see this is in, like, I don't know, like just changing lifestyle, right? Like, I know Focus talks about college as being, you know, such a crucial point in evangelization because that's when they're making all these decisions for themselves. But I've always seen high school as a really just such a formative time that you can see a lot of big conversions, big changes of lifestyle in high school. Not with everyone, because with a lot, there's still a lot of immaturity. But there's a great capacity for that change. So I would definitely agree with that. Would you say also, so like you talk about change of habits, do you know like any specific kind of instances? Like what does that look like to change a habit as an adolescent?
I'll give an example. I guess I don't have like a good real life virtue example, but I'll give an example in my soccer environment. You know, I just had last season just typical situation where the players I didn't feel were like treating practice like they should, just kind of, you know, being lax and joking around a bit. We had, you know, a period where I told them that they needed to make sure they started doing the right things, in practice at the beginning, especially. And over a matter of two or three practices, they had changed it and were practicing well and hard and playing better in game. You know, so they had the ability to turn around their habit of practicing very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely can see that. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You put also here power of young leaders. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I really have noticed, I think we're going to get into this a little bit later, but I have noticed like the fascinating dynamic of the youth social life, high school social life in particular, and just the power of the influential leaders amongst mm-hmm. that community to influence that community. So,
yeah.
You know, like there's a couple people who are just very charismatic and popular and leaders in their high school yeah. community. And, you know, they have the ability to influence and move a lot of people yeah. if they are moved in one direction or another.
Yeah. One thing I think I've noticed with that is like young people are, they seem to be very often looking for people to be inspired by, whether that's a celebrity, whether that's a YouTuber, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, where they get their role models from, where these kids get their role models from. But yeah, or even up here, right? You think of the high school dynamic, like freshmen look up to seniors, right? They are yep. going to try to imitate those people who they see as inspiring in some way. And that can be inspiring in sometimes a damaging way, right? If they're living vicious lifestyles, or in a virtuous way, right? If they have that inspiring personality, that charisma, and are actually, you know, good, positive role models. So I definitely would echo that as well. Let's see, what else do we have? I guess I looked at this question a little bit more in terms of Gen Z in particular, some things that I've noticed that seem to be different than, you know, my high school experience. And that's just, I guess, how much of their social lives are lived online is one thing. Again, I have here as well, YouTubers have a lot of sway, TikTokers, all these things. I've read some studies that showed that Gen Z actually, they spend more time online and less time with friends in person. And so actually, as a result, you see like they're actually, I've seen studies, it's hard, you know, research statistics can be flawed and misleading at times, but some of the research I've shown has indicated they're actually less sexually active, for example, because so much of their social life is lived online. Unfortunately, there's, you know, pornography and stuff online as well. And so they just are more disconnected in a in-person way, but they're more connected than ever online. In fact, what I notice is that they probably know more about their peers and their classmates just because of social media. They'll Snapchat people that they never talked to at school, you know. So they know they're, in a sense, more connected, but it's the COVID stuff we've all talked about where you're more connected in a way, but in a way you're also more disconnected.
Interesting. Yeah, can I ask if you know what the stats are for Gen Zers in terms of pornography? Like, is it higher than millennials? Do you know off the top of your head?
I have not seen a comparison to millennials.
Okay.
I would imagine it's comparable because I think millennials, it's pretty high. I can't imagine it getting much higher.
Yeah, fair
from
enough.
From what I've seen from millennials.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. I guess I'm curious if it's whether or not Gen Zs are desiring to be less sexually active, or they're still desiring to be as sexually active as millennials. They just don't feel like they can because they're not as connected.
Sure.
I'm wondering which one it is.
I don't know.
So
that's a great question.
We'll see.
And a complex question at that. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I put here, I put two more things with regard to just things I've noticed in general. With regard, you know, talking about evangelizing this generation, one of the things I've noticed, and I've noticed this since my time in Focus, and it's just been reinforced in my time working at a Catholic school, when they become religious, they become very traditional and conservative in the way they approach their faith. I've always found myself in a place where the generation as a whole is politically fairly liberal, fairly progressive on a lot of issues. But when they're drawn to the faith, they're drawn to the faith because what they see in the church is an institution that takes a principled stance on traditional issues where the rest of the world isn't. And they're very drawn to that. And they can go too far in that. And sometimes I find kind of them trending towards the kind of far right type of thinking. And I have to challenge that a little bit, which is maybe not what you would expect on the surface when you think of this as, you know, the when you look at all the political studies, millennial Gen Z are far more left as a whole.
Yeah.
So that's one interesting observation I've made for years about, you know, the youth of these days.
That's right. That's interesting, isn't it? That's really interesting. I wonder if it's probably multiple things again, probably very complex, but I wonder if it's just youth sense that being traditional says that whatever they're doing is important. You know, there's something tied to being traditional and it being important. You know, just mm-hmm. that reverence and that sense of taking the rules and the way of acting seriously, yeah, that just makes it seem more important, you know.
Yeah.
And they want something that they want something to drive. They want something important in their lives, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the traditional aspect of living out the faith gives that to them. I think maybe the less traditional, the liberal side makes it seem kind of flimsy and not as important.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
No, it does. I think that's a good way of kind of explaining one of the reasons why they're drawn to that, right? That I think tradition does represent importance, a reverence. And yeah, maybe they're not getting that. I think, and this will kind of tie in, I think my other observation actually is that I think that, you know, in the last few decades, there seems to be a trend away from longly held values, institutions, families, you know, what people see is, you know, traditional family values are changing so much. And even like just traditional virtues, like, you know, older generations we've talked about, especially for men, like we're seeing is like stoicism, you know, not showing emotion was so important, right? And I think one of the things we see in like our generation is we've kind of bucked that trend a little bit in terms of like millennials are in counseling far more than previous generations. I actually don't have a stat to prove that, but I'm sure it's true.
Yeah.
Just more emotionally aware, more aware of kind of the complexities and nuances of life, and willing to challenge traditionally held beliefs.
You're saying millennials are?
Yeah, okay. I would say for a while, yeah. Like, and our generation fits that as well. But, and so that can be taken too far, right? And I think what we see, what we're describing in this kind of traditional mindset of certain Gen Z is they see that taken too far. And so they react in the opposite extreme.
Makes sense.
But one of the things I see too is back to kind of the emotional, like the awareness of emotional distress, complexities of life, all of those things. I think our generation, millennials, have become very aware of that, you know, very big on mental health, right? Gen Z, in my experience, they're even more so that way, almost to the point where they're so in their feelings. Sometimes they're so in their emotions. And I think a lot of their views on sexuality, a lot of their views on a lot of issues are shaped by this. They're so in touch with emotions that they err on the side of being enslaved to their emotions.
Hmm.
And so I think, again, the more traditional Gen Z, they're reacting to this kind of overemphasis on emotion.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess what comes to mind right now is like the experiences I've had with some young people that I know with you know, severe mental health issues. So I'm not sure if that's tied to this or not, but I know I've had personal experience working with youth that have had, you know, a lot of mental health issues.
Yeah, and it just seems like they're more aware of it too.
Yeah,
because I'm sure mental health is worse, but I think there's also just a greater awareness of it in younger generations.
True. It's just more widely talked about also, which has to influence the generation, you know?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And in great, good ways and in bad ways, I think,
because
everything can become a mental health disorder.
That's definitely true.
You see a lot of like people diagnosing themselves with mental health disorders they don't have. And the danger in that is, as I always say, it kind of does a disservice to those who actually do have serious mental health disorders. It becomes hard to sort through what is just anxiety everybody has and what's something that's a serious disorder. So okay, I think related to this, we've kind of touched on it a few times, and I think it's relevant, we have to talk about it. What about sexuality? what do we think that this generation thinks about sexuality? And I guess as a little bit of a preface, that you asked what I meant by this earlier, I think of, like, you know, in the 60s, 70s, you got the sexual revolution, completely changed the way a lot of people think in the West think about sexuality. And, you know, millennials, I'd say we're known for hookup culture. I'd say that's kind of something that our generation has been associated with. So I'm curious if Gen Z is following, and again, the jury's still out on Gen Z in a lot of ways. We're only, mm-hmm. we're seeing them just start to come of age. But are they going to be following millennials in just kind of hookup culture? Or do they have a different perspective than millennials on sexuality?
I just don't know. And honestly, I'm afraid to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just because I work with so many of them, and it's just hard mm-hmm. to even think about it. Yeah, my sense, I touched on it earlier, but my sense is that they desire to be as sexually active as millennials. And I think it is becoming more commonplace and more accepted, to be quite honest, to, like, have sex out of wedlock mm-hmm. and to, you know, act out sexually openly, to be quite honest. I just yeah. think it's becoming more commonplace in our culture, and that yeah. has to affect Gen Z. It has to. So,
yeah, I think in a lot of ways for prior generations, hookup culture was bucking the system, right? It was countercultural, and so it was popular because of that. And now I think Gen Z is, their model is almost hookup culture, right? Like that's almost the norm. You know, millennials aren't getting married. Millennials, this is overgeneralizations, right? But they're not having children. It's perfectly normal to live together and not get married and not even have intentions of getting married, right? So what we even view as a family is changing. And on top of that, you have, I mean, the divorce and everything that we've dealt with for even longer. And so it makes me wonder, I do think the jury's still out on this one, because I feel like Gen Z can go in a number of different directions, right? They can imitate what's gone before them. They can get even more radical. I'm not sure that's necessarily what's going to happen. But yeah, I don't know that I have, other than I have seen research that they're less sexually active. I do see a big trend towards, you know, the love is love.
Oh, for sure on that.
I'd say they're totally accepting of gay marriage, even this transgender movement is exploding as well. And they're, at least on gay marriage, I'm still feeling out, I haven't seen statistics on the transgender, although they do seem to be a lot more accepting of that. It just seems to be the default. Right. It's not like, whereas maybe for millennials, it was like something you wrestled with. It seems like their default position is it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with, the gender, transgender, you know, all of that, you know, being sexually active. I mean, you see it. I think a good rule of thumb is to just kind of look in mainstream media, obviously, and forms of entertainment are tied to that. I know. We've talked about my involvement with More Than Entertained, which kind of seeks to, meet the gospel in entertainment forms. But one of the things that we've been talking a lot about in More Than Entertained is how much of a clear agenda Disney Plus has.
Oh, for sure.
Or yeah. Disney, I mean. Just as an example, I know we've, probably beaten this dead horse for a lot of listeners, but the Lightyear movie I've heard is very controversial in terms of just being openly pro-homosexual. Mm-hmm. I know That's So Raven spinoff has Raven raising children with her wife or whatever.
I didn't know there was a That's So Raven spinoff.
Yeah. Disney seems to have a huge and, obviously maybe the biggest, largest industry in entertainment, Disney. Yeah. They have a clear agenda to normalize homosexuality.
That's
right. So that... Whether or not that's bleeding into Gen Z's thinking, that I guess in theory remains to be seen, but it can only, seems to be the assumption that's safest.
Yeah.
So
yeah, so what they do with that, I think, is yet to be seen in the next 10 to 20 years, but there definitely seems to be, I'd say they're different in millennials and they're just acceptance of that. Whereas millennials maybe were, it was a tough issue. It seems like it's not even a tough issue for a lot of Gen Z.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Yeah. And honestly, too, I would say a little bit more. I mean, I know that in my experience, you know, there are people maybe around my age, our age, that are, I know, are like living with their significant others, mm-hmm. or not married, maybe they have a child, and are, like, openly talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, to anyone. I mean, it's not like a private thing.
Right. Yeah.
So that's another reason why that sort of thing is probably becoming normalized in the eyes of Gen Z too, is because it's just becoming culturally accepted.
That's right. That's right.
So
what about dating trends? Do you notice any? You maybe don't. I don't know how much you pay attention to it. But do you notice any differences in the way high schoolers are dating today versus 15 years ago?
I coach high school girls, so whenever dating comes up within earshot of me, I tend to walk away and cover my ears and please do not let me hear anything I don't want to hear, kind of a thing. Maybe that's the wrong approach, but that is my my current way that I deal with it. Yeah. So I can't say for sure. You probably know way more about this than me, mm-hmm. being in the high school classroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll have to defer to you here.
Yeah, honestly, I wish I had more insights. I think I'm the same way. I try to stay out of my students' social life, and I think I do a fairly good job of that. And I guess that's good. I don't know. But I don't know. I guess I've my assumption, this is probably my one observation in this area, is my assumption is that I know our generation was criticized for, like, not just manning up and asking a girl on a date. Because we could text, you could talk to somebody online, right? So we really bucked the traditional dating system in a lot of ways. And I think that my expectation was for Gen Z to be even more extreme than that. And it very well might be in the long run. But I seem to still see a lot of kind of in-person dating, a lot of people asking girls on dates, asking girls to dances. And maybe part of that's the high school culture.
Right.
That there's always, you know, there's dances every semester.
There's always opportunities.
You have to ask somebody. I don't know, to be honest, if they're doing it in person or over text. But they're getting dates to functions. Like, I don't see, in some ways, as much or more than from what I remember in high school of people dating and going on dates. But
yeah, we're probably making the our high school listeners cringe right now, the way we're trying to
honestly
talk about this.
Maybe we're totally off.
Yeah, maybe we are. What are these guys talking about? No, I guess my question, we can speculate. I guess my question is, like, I'm pretty sure most of us in our age group, like, did not go up and walk up to a girl at her locker and say, "Hey, what are you doing on Friday?"
Like, if you could text it, that was so much easier.
Honestly, yeah, just the easy way out. But I'm really having a hard time imagining that Gen Z reverts back to that, back to what it was before, in like the 1960s or 70s or whatever, like asking someone out, you know, on
Friday
night.
Would you like
night.
To go to the drive-in?
That's right, yeah.
Is that how they talked?
Yeah, hey, that's right, yeah. It was in England, I guess. Anyway, so I have a my grandmother always tells me this. She's told me this probably, you know, 5-10 times by now. But about when she and my grandpa met, and you know, that was, I guess, what was that in, gosh, 1950s. You know, she always says, like, you know, Nick, when Jerry, you know, asked me out, like, he came up to me one time and we'd never met before, and he came up to me and he said, "Would you like to go out on a date with me sometime?" And my grandparents are very Southern. That's why I'm kind of talking like that.
Yeah.
And she said, "I looked him up and down one time and I said, sure, I think so, yeah."
That's wild.
They got married, yeah.
I'm not seeing the kids doing that.
I'm not seeing that from Gen Z, you know, walking up to somebody they have never met before and asking them out on a date straight up. But
no, you got to do your research on social media.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Are somebody they dating anyone? Yeah. All right, anyway, we got to stop. We're making everybody cringe.
Yeah. No, this could be a good episode, though, to get feedback from high school listeners.
Maybe so.
What do you think? Are we totally off? Are we onto something? I don't know. Maybe this is what we see, though.
Yeah.
This is what we see. All right. So, I mean, I think ultimately we want to talk about, these are some of the trends, but what about evangelizing the youth? What, you know, obviously you have to understand these things, who they are as a generation. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get lost in abstracts either. Because I think that's a danger too, is we talk about generation. Oh, this is what you got to do to reach the youth. When you know how you really reach the youth, talk to them. Right? Like, don't just study them from a distance. Like, mm-hmm. you actually got to be on the ground and get to know them. And the youth is an abstract. People that we share the gospel with are individuals.
Right.
And they're not summarized by a trend, by a demographic, anything like that. Right. So anything we say here is a generalization. It's not. Yeah. So there's a danger there of generalizing too much, but
it's true.
It's also important to understand who they are as a generation. So how can we, what have we found is successful in evangelizing this generation, I guess, or unsuccessful? I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah. A couple of the things that I wrote down are, I think, nothing new. And the first one is being bold, boldly preaching the gospel, being passionate about what we believe. Mm-hmm. I think that is very attractive to young people, yeah. to anyone, but especially yeah. to young people who are still moldable and are desiring something to be passionate about, desiring true things, desiring beautiful yeah. and good things. So just being bold about the truth. That's it. I mean, that's a good starting point.
Yeah. Bold about the truth. Like, cause part of me thinks that being too bold about the truth can turn people off, right? Or do you mean more inspiring?
Sure, it can be preached with charity. Okay. I mean, I definitely don't think you should stroll into a high school classroom and, you know, tell people that are practicing homosexuality that they're going to yeah. hell boldly.
I mean, to come into a classroom on day one and preach the hard teachings of the church, I know this from experience, you're going to lose people.
Yeah.
You're going to lose a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's a different conversation about like what step A, B, and C, and D look like in proclaiming mm-hmm. the gospel to someone. Maybe I think the first step is what we used to call pre-evangelization, as maybe getting mm-hmm. to know them
yeah.
and building relationships first. Yeah. So, you know, that will probably be a better first bullet than what I was saying yeah. now, being bold. But yeah. I think, like, without, you can be bold without directly preaching the truth at yeah. someone, you know, and just being passionate, I think maybe is a yeah. better word. Like someone who sees someone that's passionate, is simply attractive.
Yeah. I think as a theology teacher, what I have found, I've been reflecting on this the last 24 hours or so. I guess what I've found is that probably the least important, I gotta be careful with what I say. The least important aspect, I'm gonna qualify this, but the least important aspect of my evangelizing my students is how I teach the material. So I think there is a certain element, and we talked about, you know, they are drawn to traditional, you know, the traditional approach of the faith. And that's important, but that's kind of there, right? If you are teaching the faith orthodoxly, right, that they'll be exposed to that, in some ways, in other ways, not, right? I think liturgies could be better. You know, they could be exposed to better liturgies. And I think we've talked about that here before, but they respond great to traditional liturgy. Now, what I mean by that is that when I've found success in building relationships and building bridges in evangelizing, bringing youth closer to the Lord and practicing their faith more seriously, is not in, I gotta teach this aspect of theology right. It's more in the relatability, in the being able to inspire. What I found probably the most effective tool is a sense of humor. Is one of the most effective tools I've found in terms of like getting students to buy into me and listen to what I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Sense of humor goes along, especially in a classroom where they're expected to be bored. If you can make it a little bit interesting and entertaining, that goes a long way. Relatability, just by virtue of being young and somewhat relevant. I think in a lot of ways I'm not relevant because I don't do any of the social media garbage, but that goes a long way. So what I've found is that it's those things, those intangible things, it's living the faith in that inspiring way that seems to draw them more so than teaching it just right.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's really true.
And the aspects of, like, yeah, the what you teach matters, how you teach it matters, but it's you know, it's like, what was it, Paul VI, I think, I could be wrong, who said, the world doesn't listen to teachers but to witnesses, and if they listen to teachers, it's because they are first witnesses. But it's about how you live it out, then they're going to listen to what you actually have to say, and it's what the church has to say is good and true and beautiful. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a heart that's open to it. It goes back to Augustine, who says the truth is like a lion. All you have to do is let it out. It'll fight for itself, mm-hmm. right? But I think what we're saying here is that, you know, whether you call it pre-evangelization or incarnational evangelization or whatever it is, the hard work is about opening hearts to receive that truth, mm-hmm. not preaching the truth exactly right, although that does matter.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, challenges then with reaching the young whippersnappers of today.
Yeah, I read a good article recently. I just finished it today, actually, in the new Word on Fire journal. Go figure. It's about childhood, the whole journal, and the article was titled something to the effect of "How to Bring About Conversion Amongst the Youth." So there you go.
Sounds familiar. Is that what inspired this?
Yeah,
topic?
I think so. Yeah. He was, and the guy, Dr. Lorenzo, that was his name. I think he's a professor at Notre Dame. Was discussing about, he was talking about how what's really important, or what's primarily important in evangelizing the youth, is understanding the soil in which they're planted. He's talking about the parable of the sower and how
that's good.
It's not the seed that's the point of the conversation in the parable of the sower. Mm-hmm. It's the soil. And how we need to understand the soil in which the youth are planted in order to understand how to evangelize them, which I thought was very powerful. So the bottom line is, like, just examining the soil of the youth today helps us figure out what the challenges are. One of the things that I mentioned on here is social pressures. I mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that when I taught, you know, I taught for a year, and also with my coaching, is that high school students can be very, very, very closed off to any sort of direction because they're so encompassed by the pressures of trying to fit in. Trying to reach a particular person in your class or and you're on my team, if they're moved by the rest of the team that's acting out of accord with what you want to teach, it's mm-hmm. very difficult to reach them.
And that's a age-old
thing
with regard to adolescence, yeah.
Age-old.
Yeah, that's so true. That always will be the issue, that always. And that's why, I don't know, I guess working with high schoolers in particular has made me more patient with the evangelization process, in the sense that, like, I see a lot of, and I've talked about this before, probably on the podcast before too, but I see a lot of high schoolers who give into social pressure in small, sometimes bigger ways, and fall into sin through that, who will eventually stop falling into that social pressure.
Hmm, yeah.
And that does give me a lot of patience for them, and realizing that much of adolescence is a rebellious spirit. And there's very sinful rebellion. There's slightly sinful rebellion. There's rebellion that's just a part of adolescence. And so
sure.
learning to see it from that perspective, I think gives you patience, right? And it makes you not count somebody out. Oh, he's never going to, you know, he's never going to become a Christian, or he's never going to take his faith seriously, or he's never going to, he's just a hypocrite, right? That's what I think I used to think is, oh, you see these people, they seem to take an interest in this Jesus thing, but I hear about them doing X, Y, Z. And to not see them as hypocrites, but see them as struggling adolescents, I mean, that's a good approach in general, just to see people as wounded sinners, not as hypocrites. But
agree.
That's gone a long way. I think I do have a lot of patience for that adolescent struggle.
Yeah, it's good.
Let's see, what else did you say here?
I got a couple of these from the article I was talking about, but one of the things that Dr. Lorenzo was talking about was this idea of like the necessity of attention, of being attentive in order to have the proper soil for evangelization. And this is something that Gen Z particularly struggles with, is this constant distraction of the of the media of, you know, I need my quick fix of information, so I'm going to go to the next thing, and then the next thing, and the next thing. There's just this very superficial attention to things, short attention spans, and that makes it very difficult to be attentive to the Word of God. So
that's something that I think back to our episode on digital minimalism with PJ, my brother PJ, who's done a lot of research on this area of distractedness and attentiveness. And go listen to that if you haven't. He has some really interesting thoughts on attentiveness as a virtue and distractedness as a vice of sorts. And this is definitely a hurdle, I think. I think this is a serious hurdle to evangelization, is there is so much distraction. There is so much, I'll just leave it at that. There's a lot of distraction.
What can someone, I'm going to put you on the spot, what can someone do who doesn't have kids but, you know, teaches and or coaches, create an environment of attention for these youths? Because, you know, one of the things that Dr. Lorenzo mentioned was just making space in the home for silence, which, I mean, that's great, but that's not going to help us. So I guess what can someone do to help youths that aren't under their immediate wing?
Well, I mean, it depends on your role. But I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me as a teacher is I strongly believe that every school should be a cell phone free zone.
Yeah.
I strongly believe that. I think that that's the number one thing. And a lot of schools have struggled with this in, the post COVID time, cause we gave them their phones during COVID cause they couldn't talk to each other. And I think a lot of schools are regretting it now because the distractedness is so, so present. You can't learn from somebody who's standing in front of you when you have the internet in your palm. And to me, that's number one. I don't know how your average person, I don't know what that would look like for you as a coach. I think fortunately you probably have them in a cell phone free environment for the most part.
I mean, you say that, but I had to get on to one of my teams a couple years ago for like, they literally during the water breaks would go over and pull their phones out and like play on their phone for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes or whatever. So, I mean, that's something that I haven't, intentionally implemented in the past couple seasons, but that actually came into my mind that I should try and do. That would be something very specific that I could easily do.
Yeah.
Hey, no phones out when we're practicing.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, I think that's a great starting place.
Yeah.
So that's my answer. What about this distance from suffering? Where'd you get that?
So this is a very interesting one, actually. I think very true. So I got it from the article again, these last two that I put down here. He was talking about how we have, because of media, because of the internet, all of these encounters with suffering. Key example being like, we can pull up pictures of Ukrainians suffering during the war across the world.
Yeah.
Without the ability, really, to display merciful acts towards these people that we're seeing suffer. So that's one of the things he mentioned. So, like, we're getting... What's happening is we are associating... our feelings of, you know, compassion towards these people that are suffering with inaction. So There's all of these encounters with suffering without the accompanied act of mercy that should come from the feeling of seeing someone suffering.
Yeah.
So one of the things that he was mentioning was, you know, building spaces for the youth where they can be merciful. You know, building, and he didn't go into specifics, but like building spaces where they can encounter suffering directly and act mercifully towards those periods.
So this is a really interesting and complicated question, because I'm going to start off with saying, I feel this in myself. Mm-hmm. I feel, this is kind of, I don't know if it's convicting or what, but I feel very little compassion at reading news stories of things going across the world.
That's another factor too. Yeah.
I don't think that's a young people. That's a, I think it's a largely a product of the way we receive news, and how globalized we are and how unconnected we are locally. But I feel that very in my bones. I think in some ways my students feel greater compassion. I think there's something in, teens are very oriented towards justice and social justice and seeing things be made right. Injustice really bothers them. Mm-hmm. So I see them get very worked up about civil rights issues, about genocide across the world, about Russia-Ukraine stuff, right? I see them get worked up about it, but you're right about there's, what is action then in that? Is action maybe is posting on social media or just having an emotional reaction but not being able to do anything about it? So I think there's a, it's a very complicated thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I feel it totally in myself as well.
Yeah. You know, you wonder if it's just as simple as creating opportunities, like in the high school environment, for example, the high school, building opportunities for students to use acts of mercy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Know? Oh, yeah.
It's as simple as that. Maybe, maybe just going, I'm just going to use cliche examples, but I'm sure you can get creative and better with it. But, you know, going to the local soup kitchen or, you know, reaching out for the homeless in some way, or, you know, honestly, like cleaning up the trail, the local trail, you know, just things like that to get the students outside of themselves.
Yeah, that's a great, is a great point, because there is only so much you can do about genocide in Africa.
Right.
There is something you can do. There are a lot of things you can do locally, and it doesn't solve the genocide in Africa, but it plugs you in to knowing that there are problems in the world, in my local community, and I can do something.
That's right.
About it, right? I can be plugged in. I can engage in a more tangible way with the suffering of others.
Yeah.
So that's good.
That's a huge aspect of Christianity. You know, the the Good Samaritan story, I think, is one of the things that was mentioned in the article, is like there's this clear walking along the path, encountering some suffering, and then a physical action to action of mercy to alleviate that suffering. You know, and how many opportunities do the youth have to do that?
I don't know. And it's a dangerous thing when we live so much of our lives in this globalized, electronically connected world, where there is that separation from compassion and inaction, separation between the two, and then you encounter somebody along your way who is in suffering. I've felt this in my own experience of, there just seems to be less of an instinct to help the in-person person when you're living, so much of your thoughts are revolved around this digital world.
That's right.
That becomes more real than the person you're walking right by who's suffering.
And I think we associate, this is another one of the things I'm pulling here from Dr. Lorenzo, but I think we associate like the feeling of compassion when we see suffering with that's good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like
I'm a good person.
Yep. I feel compassionate towards someone who I see suffering, so that's good. I'm good.
So if I don't feel compassion about when I read news stories, what does that make me? Am I not even there?
Man, you way far along. No, I'm kidding. No, I honestly, no. I mean, I think, like, first of all, I think acting mercifully towards suffering creates the feeling I don't know if it does all the time, but I think that it helps build the feeling of compassion. That's another question, I think, but
I think you're totally right. Yeah, action breeds compassion.
Yeah,
it's a near rhyme.
Indeed.
You heard it here first.
Colloquium.
Gosh, we're kind of running out of time here, but I mean,
I really like your other.
Yeah, ones, I do. But I'm gonna touch on those. Yeah. So two other challenges. One is indifference. What was I thinking with this? I know you like the culture of indifference. You don't like the culture.
Yeah, I like, talking about it. Yeah.
I honestly forget what I was thinking when I put this. So do you have any thoughts on that? And we'll see if it jars anything for me.
This is tied to preaching the gospel boldly is kind of one of the reasons why I put this down, is because like the tendency to indifference and mediocrity. And one of them, I think maybe the best quote that sums up the way to reach in those who are indifferent is from Flannery O'Connor, who says, you know, to the hard of hearing, you shout, to the near blind, you draw large and startling figures. So, you know, there is, seems to be like this, honestly, I think it's like a paralysis of where to put my energy.
Yeah.
You know, as a Gen Zer, as a youth, and like shaking the youth out of this sort of paralysis, this sort of inability to move and to put their energy towards something, I think is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I think where I was going with this is, I think something I saw a lot in my work with college students in Colorado is like kind of the apathy of like in the relativism of, that's great that you found Jesus, and I can see that's really good for you and helped you a lot, but I don't need to find Jesus too. I've got, you know, whatever, right? That's what I see more and more, I think, with younger generations coming of age, is it's this, not a sense of urgency about religious matters. It's a sense of respect. Like, I don't think we're in as... I think in some ways we are very post-Christian, anti-Christian age, but I don't think we're as much so there as often gets talked about by Christians. I think in a lot of places it's just this general apathy towards Christianity of, there's these great aspects, there's these aspects I don't like, I don't need it, it's good for you, great. If it helps you, good.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah. I think we have more faith in our mental health professionals than our pastors.
Yeah, that's true. Man, yeah. Ooh, those are incriminating words.
Yeah, we can put that on the audiogram.
That'll be our title.
Okay, and then the last one is, I think this is a real hurdle as well, and an interesting one. I struggle with how much this is actually a hurdle, and maybe I'll say why in a minute. But just political and social trends of Gen Z seem so contrary to the church. And it seems to be, especially as a theology teacher, like a stumbling block. When you look at these trends, just how embracing of the LGBTQ agenda, not just sympathetic to, but like full-on embracing abortion. You know, the tides are changing there too. More and more young people are in support of it. Mm-hmm. We talked about social trends with marriage, all these things. That seems to me to be a hurdle, right? Is that just the default positions of the youth are not just, I don't just mean they're against certain church teachings, but they're fundamentally, it's a different view of the human person than Christian anthropology. And that to me seems to be a hurdle in a lot of ways. Granted, I do think with conversion, views change, right? And often the political views are way, way, way downwind of conversion.
Yeah.
You encounter Christ, and then Christ is going to transform your heart, change your views on things, and that'll look different for different people. There are certain things where, like, you know, you're going to be in agreement on. There are certain, you know, there are Catholics that think differently politically. I'm not saying that a Catholic has to have all the same exact same political views, but there's a certain sense in which you can work with varying political views to a degree. but it seems to me hard to work with a totally different view of the human person.
I agree. Do you have a particular example of something that indicates that the default view is that that are of like a totally different aspect of the human person?
I think the biggest one, and I work with, you know, I work with a lot of nominally Catholic kids, so it's different than probably different than the kids you work with and just the overall population. So I don't necessarily see a lot of pro-choice rhetoric.
Totally secular, yeah.
But I do see a lot of default embracing of LGBT.
Yeah.
And that, it's hard to talk about because it is something that, yeah, there are a lot of young people that I really, really care deeply for that are just totally embracing of it. And I see when I have conversations with them about, it's just fully embraced, not just, you know, homosexual activity, but just the whole gender fluidity movement as well. And it's such a sensitive thing, and that's why I hesitate, but that's just where I see it's like their default coming about it from such a radically different perspective than I'm used to.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, and it's the default, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm surprised this didn't come up in our conversation, but I know you guys at your high school, John Paul II, are talking about implementing theology of the body. Is this the first year? It's being implemented as a course? Is that right? Or just
it's
being
integrated into our theology curriculum for all 4 years?
Beautiful. Yeah. So I mean, that seems to be a particularly powerful way to resonate with young people is through theology of the body and just the idea of how our bodies proclaim the gospel in just every sense.
And I think that could be another conversation. I think we can have an episode on that at some point.
Sure.
Because I want to do it justice. And I'm still figuring it out, too. I think that theology of the body is a difficult thing to teach because, again, it's coming from a view of the human person that in a lot of ways is different from what these kids are growing up with.
Yeah, and it's good news. It's great news.
Theology of the body is such good news.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It is the gospel. Mm-hmm. But learning how to present it in an age-appropriate way, I think, is the challenge.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
All right. Well, that's a podcast, I think.
Indeed.
Cool.
And in word. It's my phrase lately. Every time I say indeed, anyway, go ahead.
Cool. I don't have anything else to say.
Nice.
So, you know our socials. colloquiumshow@gmail.com is our email. Send us your questions, thoughts, feedback. Hate mail is addressed to Nick. And pay attention to Nick's cool little Instagram stories. They're fun sometimes. And we'll see you next time on Colloquium. Praise be Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.
Amen.